Live from Dominican University of California, it's another Institute for Leadership Studies lecture, part of the Dominican ILS lecture series for 2013. Tonight, Bill McKibben is our guest at Angelico Concert Hall, live from Dominican University of California, and we will have Mr. McKibben and his talk in its entirety right here on Penguin Radio tonight, radio.dominican.edu. Glad you're with us.
We're thrilled to have you here. Are you happy to be here? This is our opening night of our fall series of the Institute for Leadership Studies in partnership with Book Passage, and I'm wondering if any of you have ever attended our lecture series before. Yes? Can I hear a woo-hoo if you have? Well, I'm so happy, and I know you've heard about the great series that's coming up this fall. My name is Denise Lucy. I'm the executive director and professor here in our School of Business and Leadership at the Institute. That is so happy to have my remarkable students and faculty and staff colleagues who greeted you tonight. I hope you felt welcomed by them. Let's thank them. They're volunteering. This is all volunteer time. So thank you, student ambassadors and staff support. So the Institute for Leadership Studies is a leadership development center, and we provide training and development, degree programs, and events like these to engage the community in important ideas across the disciplines about how people change the world. And what a wonderful evening we're going to have tonight. I'm specifically interested because I keep honeybees. And as my mother said, she can't wait to see her 50,000 grandchildren next time she visits me. And you know, when you know honeybees, I don't know, whom among you know anything about the honeybee world? Quite a few of you. And when we talk about leadership and we speak about how leaders bring others to achieve a common goal, well, honeybees have a common goal. And they are in cooperation. And this is the kind of thing we need to do more of in our world. And it's so spectacular to have our speaker tonight who has brought us together to change the world in positive ways. I'd like to mention that our series is not only live, but we do film them, and those films are shown at the Comedia Media Center of Marin on Wednesday nights at 8 o'clock. And also we are recording live on Penguin Radio, and those are podcasts. So you can get access to those both podcasts and videos from the Dominican University of California /leadership website. Hope you'll come and visit and send your friends. This program could not exist without the wonderful support and partnership of Book Passage. Book Passage is amazing! And because all of you support our bookstore, we actually can have one here. So thank you all of you to help Book Passage remain at the community center that it is here in Marin and in San Francisco. And we also have a sponsor for these last 3 years, Private Ocean Wealth Management. And are they community oriented or what? This is an amazing organization. Richard Stone, who is the co-founder and the chairman of the board, is going to introduce our speaker tonight. But I just wanted to just note that Private Ocean Wealth Management is named 7 times by Worth Magazine as one of the top 100 registered investment advisors nationwide, and just in 2013 was named by North Bay Biz as the 2013 best wealth management firm in Marin, and we are so thrilled that they are supporting our series the entire year. Please thank Private Ocean Wealth Management with me. And Richard, Mr. Stone, is also on our board of trustees. That's great, isn't it? He is the chair of our finance committee, and he's been a supporter of helping our institution move forward. He has served as a leader in wealth management for over 40 years, and he has received the prestigious Charles Schwab Impact Leadership Award for Lifetime Achievement by the financial industry. And without his support and partnership, we wouldn't be here this evening. Please welcome Mr. Richard Stone.
of the nice perks here is that Denise shares her honey with me that she makes down the street, so that's a nice thing. Thank you, Denise. Our guest speaker tonight, Bill McKibben, is an author, educator, and environmentalist. He's founder of 350.org, a global grassroots movement to build and preserve a sustainable planet. It is... Go ahead. Let's hear it. It has coordinated 20,000 demonstrations in more than 180 countries. Time magazine has called Mr. McKibben the planet's best green journalist. In his latest book, Oil and Honey, Bill gets personal. His fight for the environment takes on two sides. One focuses on large-scale national and political battle against the fossil fuel industry. That resulted in a protest at the White House against the Keystone XL pipeline, a protest that proudly landed Bill in jail. The other centers on individual responsibility and humility. Bill chronicles his partnership with Kirk Webster, a small-scale beekeeper who raised and sold bees, hives, and honey around the Vermont area. In the course of 25 years, Bill has progressed from president of the Harvard Crimson to a champion of the environmental cause. On October 19th, he will be recognized at Warner Brothers Studios in Burbank to receive a Lifetime Achievement Award at the 23rd Annual Environmental Media Awards. Please join me in welcoming best-selling author and renowned environmental activist, Bill McKibben.
Well, thank you. What a pleasure. What a pleasure. What a pleasure to be here. What a pleasure to be here. What a pleasure to be back in the company of the good people from Book Passage. I was saying earlier when we were talking back up at Edge Hill Mansion that that communities that took their local independent bookstores for granted no longer have local independent bookstores, so don't take yours for granted. It's a pleasure to be at Dominican. This is the prettiest campus I've just about ever seen, and it's on the prettiest day I've just about ever remember. And it makes me feel all the guiltier for the fact that I'm essentially a kind of professional bummer-outer of people, you know? And here I have lured you all in to hear dark and grim thoughts, and I'll try to get through those very quickly and on to something nicer as fast as I can. But let's do just talk completely seriously for just a minute and get it out of the way. Just sort of talk about where we are, because I know you all know about climate change, but it's the scale and the pace of the problem that determines the scale and the pace of the solution, and the news really isn't very good. I wrote the first book about global warming 25 years ago, a book called The End of Nature, and at the time it was all still abstract. We knew that when you burned coal and gas and oil, you put carbon into the atmosphere. We knew the molecular structure of CO2, trapped heat that would otherwise radiate back out to space. We had a pretty good idea that what was going to happen, but we didn't know how fast and we didn't know how hard it would pinch. This was an experiment carried out, you know, for the first time with human observers. And the bad news is that it has gone faster and farther than we would have thought in that brief period of time. So far, humans have burned enough fossil fuel to increase the temperature of the Earth about 1 degree. That doesn't sound like an enormous amount. In fact, in some ways, it isn't. I mean, the extra carbon we've put in the atmosphere traps enough heat that it's the equivalent of adding about 0.75 watts of solar energy per square meter of the Earth's surface. So less than one of those small white Christmas tree lights per square meter. And not very much, except that there are actually a lot of square meters on the surface of the Earth. So it adds up. Someone this summer calculated how much it added up. They figured out that we were daily adding the heat equivalent of putting off about 400,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs, okay? But that's abstract, too. I mean, to really understand what's going on, you have to look at the results. By the end of last summer, 80% of the summer sea ice in the Arctic that was there 40 years ago was gone. We'd taken one of the largest physical features on Earth and broken it. Think about how much heat it takes to melt feet of ice in the Arctic that has been there for thousands of years. The oceans are 30% more acidic than they were 40 years ago. The chemistry of seawater changes as it absorbs carbon from the atmosphere. In essence, you might say, the fossil fuel industry has decided to use our oceans as their private ocean, almost, and change its chemistry on our behalf. On land, we see, most obviously, the effects on hydrology, on the way that water moves around the Earth. If you want one fact to remember for the 21st century, it's that warm air holds more water vapor than cold. The atmosphere is about 5% wetter than it used to be 40 years ago. That's a huge change in a basic physical parameter of the planet. What it means in practice is that the dice are loaded for drought and for flood, both of which we see with increasing and alarming frequency on this Earth. Think about this year in California, which overall is the driest year we've yet seen in recorded history in California, and hence no surprise that we saw the biggest fire ever recorded in the Sierra Nevada, burning straight across the landscape that really gave rise to the modern environmental movement, the place where John Muir first figured out this sort of grammar and rhetoric of wildness that allowed us to see the world through new eyes, but now even in those remote places, deeply affected. And one mountain range over, of course, in the Rockies, you saw the pictures of what happened in Colorado last week. Absolutely unprecedented rainfall. There's rainfall records in Boulder dating back 100 and some years. This year, Boulder beat its all-time annual rainfall record by the middle of September. There's still 3 months to go out there, and they're already past their annual rainfall record. That should be statistically impossible, you know, with that kind of data set, but it's a different world than those old records were set on, and different things can happen. We've increased temperature of the planet 1 degree. That's what happens. The trouble is, if we keep doing what we're doing, on the current trajectory, we'll increase it 4 or 5 degrees before this century is out. And if that happens, then we can't have a civilization like the one that we're used to having. Agronomists at Stanford and the University of Washington a couple years ago put out a study saying that from this point on, each degree increase in the global average temperature should cut grain yields by 10%, i.e., if we raise the temperature 2, 3, 4 degrees, we cut the number of calories on the planet 20, 30, 40%. That's completely understandable when you look at what happened in the American Midwest last summer when it got too hot to grow corn in the most fertile farm. It didn't matter that Iowa is 100 feet of topsoil. If the temperature is above 95 degrees at the crucial period, corn won't fertilize. So trillions of kernels of corn did not fertilize, and a lot of people went hungry. That's a recipe for a completely unmanageable, impossible world. The greatest threat to social justice, to the future, to all the things that we care about that we've ever come up against. This is by far the biggest thing that human beings have ever done, and so we've got to stop it, and that's what I want to talk about tonight. I want to talk about it in a couple of ways. The reason that we haven't done anything yet, the reason that we've had, say, in Washington, a 25-year bipartisan effort to accomplish nothing that's been entirely successful is not because the science isn't understood. The scientists have gone up to Capitol Hill year after year after year after year and said what was going on, and they've been followed by the economists, left, right, and center, who have said over and over again, look, First thing you might want to do is stop letting the fossil fuel industry be the only industry on Earth that's allowed to throw out its waste for free. Nobody else gets to do that. But if you're Exxon, you're allowed to use the atmosphere as your private sewer. And that's why they're the most profitable industry on Earth by a large margin. Exxon has made more money last four years, than any company in the history of money, you know. That's why they're so that's why it takes so long to get the solar and the wind and the things that we know we need in place, because they have to swim upstream against this completely fake economy created and preserved by the fossil fuel industry. It's not just that they burn the carbon, it's that they make sure nothing ever changes. Their wealth is enough to preserve the status quo. 2 weeks before the last election, your sort of local power that be, Chevron, gave the largest campaign contribution, corporate campaign contribution ever, largest since the Citizens United decision. And they gave it 2 weeks before the last election, and they gave it to make sure that the House of Representatives would stay in the hands of climate deniers, and they were successful, and so nothing will happen in Washington for the next couple years. Up against that kind of money power, some of us some years ago decided that if change was going to happen, it would happen only if we were able to kind of find a different currency to work in. We were not going to outspend these guys. Instead, we're going to have to find the currencies of movement, passion, spirit, creativity, maybe sometimes spend our bodies. And I want to talk for a minute about that, because it's a world that I knew nothing about when I started. I'm not an activist by training or inclination. I'm a writer. Writers are by nature introverts. Given my druthers, I would rather, I mean, it's very nice to be with y'all, but I'd actually rather be home in my study typing, you know? But at a certain point, it occurred to me that writing yet another book about this was unlikely to change the outcome, you know? So with seven undergraduates at Middlebury College in Vermont, where I teach a college just like this one, same kind of students, same kind of beautiful campus, same kind of... we set out to form this thing called 350.org, of which there are many of the excellent local representatives here from all around the Bay Area, and 350 Marin in particular. And 350 Marin is doing all sorts of great things, including, it must be said, convincing the Board of Supervisors to put a moratorium on fracking earlier this year. If you want to learn more about them or join in, October 29th, San Anselmo, First Presbyterian Church, or you can go to 350marin.org. All right. We set out to start this, well, we set out ludicrously to start this global organizing effort. That's one of the reasons we have this kind of strange name, 350.org. It's the most important number in the world, but nobody knew it until a few years ago, when Jim Hansen at NASA, our foremost climatologist, and his team put out a paper saying, we know enough about carbon now to know how much is too much. Any value for CO2 in the atmosphere greater than 350 parts per million is not compatible with the planet on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted. That's strong language. Strong language for scientists. Stronger still if you know that outside today, in Marin or in Mongolia or any place else on Earth, the atmosphere is about 400 parts per million CO2, going up 2 parts per million per year, already way too high. That's why the Arctic melts. It's why Yosemite burns. It's why Boulder floods, you know. So it was a depressing paper to read. On the other hand, we thought, that number may give us the thing we need, because we were worried that we might not somehow, the seven of us, be able to organize the entire globe immediately. our problem, we thought, was that you know, everybody insists on speaking their own language, so it'd be difficult to get the idea across. But Arabic numerals cross those linguistic boundaries, you know. 350 means the same thing no matter where you are, you know. And so we started this thing called 350.org, and we went to work, and it was ludicrous, but there were seven young people, and there are seven continents. So in 2008, each one took one. The guy who drew the Antarctic also had to take care of the internet, you know. Fair was fair. And off we went to work, and our work was to find other people like ourselves around the world. There's not every place in the world someone called an environmentalist, but there are always people who are interested in hunger, war and peace, development, women's rights, all the things you can't have on a planet that's degrading, disintegrating, you know. And so they were our natural allies, and we told everybody, come together, we're going to do something on one day to kind of try and drive this number into the information bloodstream of the planet a little bit. And so about a year after we started, we had this first day of action, and we had no idea how it was going to work. We didn't have any real reason to hope for huge success, given our lack of resources or anything, but we got a sense it might work. 2 days early, we were sitting around our office, the one-room office we had, around the one table we had, and the satellite phone rang, and it was our leader in Ethiopia. And like many of our leaders, she was a she. And like many of our leaders, she was 17. And I was thinking about that, Corey, when you were talking earlier today. She was in tears. And she said, the government took away our permit for Saturday. So we're doing this today before they can stop us, which was brave, but that wasn't why she was crying. She was just kept saying, we wanted to do this the same time as everybody else. We wanted to be part of the thing all over the world at the same time. We don't want to spoil it for people. We're so sorry. And we have 15,000 young people out in the street right now in Addis Ababa. So I was like, you know, wow, don't worry about the date. It's okay, you know, whenever. And for the next 72 hours or so, the pictures just rolled in from all over the world. Before the weekend was over, there were 5,200 demonstrations in 181 countries. CNN called it the most widespread day of political action in the planet's history. I'll show you just a very, very, very few. But the thing I mostly want to, well, the second one came from U.S. troops in Afghanistan, made a 350 with sandbags. We're parking our Humvee for the weekend and walking, okay? But as they rolled in, the thing that was important to me to see was I'd always been told that environmentalism was something that rich white people did. And if you had to worry where your next meal was coming from, you wouldn't be an environmentalist. And that just turned out to be nonsense. Most of the people we were working with around the world, we were talking about this earlier, were poor and black and brown and Asian and young. And that's what most of the world is composed of. And what do you know, they're as interested in the future as anybody else, maybe more so, because the future is bearing down hard on you right now in those places. And they were creative and powerful. Great involvement of religious communities for the first time in this work. As the head of Muslim South Africa, of indigenous traditions in South Africa, the Anglican Archbishop who succeeded Desmond Tutu at the head of a big multi-faith march across South Africa. That's our biggest evangelical college in this country. I'd been to Bethlehem to do some organizing. Too many barriers in the way to around the Dead Sea to do it all together, but the Jordanians said, we'll make the three. The Palestinians said, we'll do the five. The Israelis said, we'll make the zero on our beach, and it was a pretty spectacular day. Big demonstrations across China, 300 of them. One of them did get broken up by the police. It's a hard place to do this stuff, but the rest went off. China's an important part of this story. Those are our allies in the Maldives. That's their student government association. They're meeting in the lagoon to illustrate the problem they have. The Maldives are an archipelago of 1,200 islands out across a vast swath of the Indian Ocean, across the equator. They're a 5,000-year-old culture. They're probably not going to be a 5,100-year-old culture. The highest point in the archipelago is 1.5 meters above sea level. Not a good place to be all of a sudden, now that we've started the seas to quickly rising. This was the biggest story on Google News for 36 hours, and the reason, I think, was because people didn't look the way that editors thought they would, you know? Every woman in that, this is Yemen, which is a tough place to begin with, but every woman in that zero is wearing a full black burqa. They don't look to us like members of the Sierra Club, but their hearts are in precisely the same place, you know? They're thinking not about themselves, but about the future, about other people. That's Abu Dhabi. It's oil-rich sheikdom. You can actually see some oil-rich sheikhs down front in their dishdashes. But smarter than the average oil man, behind them you'll see the edge of the largest solar array on planet Earth. Okay, they're determined, I think, to remain rich no matter what, and more power to them, you know, as they go. There were 400 or 500 pictures that ended up in a file just marked 350 adorable, and they were adorable. And they were also really hard to look at. Those girls are going to be refugees, most likely, and not through any fault of their own, you know. Most of the carbon that's in the atmosphere at the moment came from the United States, because we've been burning it a long time. And CO2 stays in the atmosphere for about 100 years, okay? So it'll outlive all of us, the carbon that we poured into the atmosphere. I could show you pictures like this for a very long time. As Richard said, we've organized 15, 20,000 of these things around the world, and they're beautiful to look at, and I actually can do it all day. I like doing it because it reminds me of how many people, how brave, you know, it's kind of brave to plant a tree in Somalia at this point after all these years of drought. You know, places I've loved, places I've never heard of, places I've heard of in other contexts, you know, but all of them united by the fact that we have one planet and the same physics apply across it. And so people understand the number and understand what's going on. And we've used all the tools we can think of, art chief among them. We did a project, the largest art project, they called it, in history. Some of these images so big you needed a satellite to really capture them. There's 3,000 people in Brighton making an image of King Canute trying to hold back the rising seas, you know. Those are solar panels that scarab beetle is pushing across the desert. And that was maybe my favorite. That's a now dry riverbed in the drought-ridden part of New Mexico. But when the satellite came over, a couple of thousand people held blue blankets overhead all of a sudden to kind of bring the river back to life for a minute. And so beautiful. So we're proud of this educational work, and it's the kind of work that we think is important to do, and we're going to keep doing, and so on and so forth. But education, not enough. Given the trouble that we're in, we got to fight some too. We've got to really try and sometimes be willing to confront a little bit. You may have heard a little bit of this battle that we've been waging the last couple of years over the Keystone Pipeline down from the tar sands of Alberta to the Gulf of Mexico. The reason we got involved in the fight was not just the horrible damage it was doing up there in Alberta, which is a just horrible mess across the ancestral lands of all kinds of indigenous people, but because there's so much carbon up there. If you could burn all the economically recoverable oil in Alberta tonight, the current level of concentrated carbon, 400 parts per million, already too high, would go to 540 parts per million. That's why Jim Hansen, again at NASA, said, burn that stuff and it's game over for the climate. So that's why people showed up to go to jail in the biggest civil disobedience action in 30 years in this country about anything. And those people, those people going to jail, and there are a few of them in this room tonight, thank you guys very much, those people going to jail were enough to so far stop this for 2 years. We followed the nonviolent protests spread across Canada. It went to embassies and consulates around the world. We followed the president all around the country. We surrounded the White House five deep, shoulder to shoulder, around that mile and a half perimeter. And the president said, okay, we'll reevaluate it. And it was supposed to last a year, and it's been 2 years, and so we've kept 900,000 barrels of oil a day in the ground, and we don't know how this decision's going to come out. He's under intense pressure from the fossil fuel industry, which never loses. But we're very hopeful that the president, if we continue to push him, will make the right decision. If he does, it'll be the first time, the very first time, that a world leader has ever said, here's a big project we're not going to build because of its effect on the climate. And if he does, it'll be not only the beginning of a real climate legacy for him, but it will be a wedge to reopen those international negotiations on climate that collapsed in Copenhagen in 2009. So we fight as hard as we know. We play defense against all kinds of things. I've just been up in Portland and Seattle, where they're trying to block the construction of these coal ports along the Pacific Northwest, because that would be a kind of cork in the bottle that would keep them from digging up much of the Powder River Basin coal in Montana and Wyoming. Another one of these pools of carbon that's just too big to be allowed out into the atmosphere. And so we're very hopeful. People are working very hard. They're going to jail there too. They're doing all that they can. Down here, you've got this fight that needs to be taken on to keep the oil in the Monterey Shale unfracked, and down there where it's been for many millions of years, because there's too much carbon in it. At this point, finding new sources of oil or gas or coal is the most dangerous thing we could possibly be doing. We need no more of it. In fact, the kind of math about carbon in the atmosphere is sort of allowing us now not just to play defense against bad projects, but to play a kind of offense against this industry. I wrote a piece for Rolling Stone last summer. For those of you who keep your back issues, it was the one with Justin Bieber on the cover. And but the strange thing was, I got a call from the editor a couple of days after it came out and said, this is odd, but your piece has 10 times as many likes on Facebook as Justin's. And it turned into, I think, the most shared piece they've ever had. And the reason was that it laid out this new math of climate change. Three numbers. There's some of you here who are good at numbers, okay? First number's 2 degrees. Remember I told you we'd raised the temperature 1 degree already? That melted the Arctic. The only red line that the world's ever drawn about climate change, the only thing that the international community ever agreed on about climate change, was that 2 degrees would be too much. In fact, it's much too high a number. I mean, in a rational world, if 1 degree melted the Arctic, we would not want to find out what 2 degrees would do. But we're going to find out. Even if we do everything right, we're probably going to stop just around there. So that's the one red line. Everybody, even the U.S., signed off on this 2-degree target. Second number, and the scientists can tell us with some precision how much more carbon we can burn and have a reasonable chance of staying below 2 degrees. The number's roughly 565 gigatons, 565 billion tons of carbon. That sounds like a lot. A billion tons of anything is a lot. But at current rates of burning, it takes us about 14 years to get through it. Okay, so that's a bad number. But the bad, bad number is the third one. It comes from a team of financial analysts in the UK. And they went and looked up all the SEC filings and annual reports of the fossil fuel industry and of the countries, think Venezuela, that kind of operate like fossil fuel companies. And what they found was that these guys already have in their reserves of coal and oil and gas 2,800 gigatons, five times as much as the most conservative governments or scientists on Earth say would be safe to burn. But they are going to burn it. That's what their business plans call for. That's what they've told investors and banks that they will do. Unless we change the story, the ending of it's already written. I mean, there's no longer any room for doubt. And once you know those numbers, you know why the fossil fuel industry is no longer a normal industry, why it now is a rogue industry. If it carries out its business plan, the planet tanks. And it isn't enough for them just to sit on what they have. They constantly look for more. Exxon boasts about spending $100 million a day looking for more hydrocarbons to burn. $100 million a day. What we need is for them to become energy companies, not fossil fuel companies, at a minimum. We may need much deeper things than that, but we need them to stop doing that. And they will not stop doing that until at least we put a serious price on carbon and end their business model as they know it at the moment. And for that to happen, we have to overcome their political power, which is why, 10 months ago, we launched this divestment movement in this country. We modeled it on the one that 25 years ago helped bring an end to apartheid. 155 campuses in this country divested their stock in companies that did business in South Africa. Many cities, states, towns. And it was effective. When Nelson Mandela got out of prison, the first place he came was California. And he went straight to the university, the UC system. I think he went to Berkeley. And he said to people, students there, you forced the divestment of $3 billion worth of stock in these companies, and that was a key part of, we liberated ourselves, but we could not have done it without you. His great accomplice, Desmond Tutu, the greatest churchman in the world at the moment, although I must say, it looks like Pope Francis is determined to give him a run for his money, thank heaven. Desmond Tutu last year said, when we launched this divestment push, it was sort of because he said, if you could see what drought and famine were doing to Africa, you'd understand why I'm asking you to take up these tools again to divest from these companies. We can't bankrupt them economically, but we can bankrupt them politically. We can turn them into the tobacco companies of today, okay? And so it's been fun to watch this start to spread much faster than we thought it would. Seven colleges have already divested. It's early days, but seven, including San Francisco State, 380 college campuses. We have a big fight going on already. We're very hopeful that people here at Dominican will make this a big fight here very quickly. Among other things, the sort of good news is, I guess, that one could do it at low cost, if any. The Associated Press did a story last year, an independent study earlier this year they commissioned, and they found that an institution with a $1 billion endowment that had divested from fossil fuel 10 years ago would have made $119 million more in the last decade, even at today's college prices. That's a lot of scholarships and things, you know. But that's not why we want people to do it. We want them to do it for moral reasons. If it is wrong to wreck the climate, it is wrong to profit from the wreckage of the climate. And so it's been good to see not only those colleges, it's been good to see cities and towns across this country, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, Providence, many others, commit to divesting their holdings. Now we're very hopeful that people are, you know, hard at work trying to get CalPERS and others to do the same thing. Our religious denominations are beginning to go along. The Unitarians have announced that they'll spend the next year talking about this. And Unitarians like to talk, and they'll figure out sort of what to do. The United Church of Christ, our pretty much oldest Protestant denomination that traces its roots back to the, you know, Mayflower and the Pilgrims, decided earlier this year that they would divest from fossil fuel. Argument sort of being, we really can't pay the pastor by investing in companies that run Genesis in reverse, you know, that's not okay. And so this move is on. It's going to be a hard fight because these guys are very rich and powerful, and because there's a lot of inertia in systems, and even institutions that we love are sometimes slow to do these things. Middlebury College, where I teach, which is a wonderful place and has the oldest environmental studies department in the country and things. But they, you know, they've got, they may have a little more money than's good for them almost. It make them a little wary of this sort of, so they're so far dragging their feet. But they won't forever, because people will people there who came out of that school were better trained, you know. They'll hold them to the ideals that they learned in college. They'll push and push. I just learned that I'm going to get a prize from some Norwegians for $50,000. And so I'm going to turn around and donate it to Middlebury, but it's going to come with a little note that says, you need to hold this in escrow until such time as you divest. And I very much hope that those of you who are alumni of anything will do the same. It's actually really important. I'm looking at the demographics of this hall. For those of us of a certain age, to be engaged in this fight along with the young people who've been leading it from the beginning. And maybe I'll... Well, let me do two things. I've harangued at you long enough. Let me do two things. Would it be all right to just read a little bit from this book for a second? I'll read you a part, a little bit gentler part. It's half about all this stuff that I've been talking about, this work we've been doing, and it's half about the place where I live and the reasons, in a sense, that we do it. The hope that we can build, rebuild the kind of working local places that are we desperately need and that are so attractive. It's fun to be in a place like Vermont where I live or in Northern California where people are advanced in this work, where we can see the outlines of what the world could look like after fossil fuel, and I wanted to write about that. And the vehicle I chose was a neighbor of mine named Kirk Webster, who's the best, wonderful apiarist, beekeeper. He was the first chemical-free, really, apiarist in the country. And as you know, beehives are under great assault. We think maybe half the beehives in America died last year. But his have done well. And anyway, bees are just charming creatures, as it turned out. So I thought I'd spend a lot of time with him as much as I could whenever I was home, which wasn't often enough. But, well, let me just read you a little bit about the bees and then about it sort of, I'm afraid, wanders back into all this other stuff. This was set in, this part comes from the spring of 2012. Now, not on the West Coast, but in the rest of America, that was the most anomalous stretch of weather in American history. Beginning in mid-March, suddenly the temperature just went out of control. In the Dakotas, it reached the 90s before winter was over. Across the Midwest and the East, the temperature day after day was 30, 40, 50 degrees above average. There were places where the low temperature for the day beat the all-time high temperature record for that spot. Okay, just statistically impossible, but it was happening. And of course, every tree flowered 6 weeks early and so on. But the bees, unperturbed and adaptable, were doing their best to ensure there'd be honey. Soon, at one of the bee yards, Kirk's bee yards, I sat in the ground for a while next to one box, watching them return in a steady stream. Each had its twin saddlebags bulging with dull yellow pollen, probably from ornamental silver maples in a nearby front yard. Watching them, you began to realize how it was all possible. Each clump of pollen was tiny, the size of a kernel of corn on one of those weird baby ears you get in Chinese restaurants. But the river of bees never stopped. You could almost feel it adding up. Bees lead the animal world in cheap metaphor production. But there are times when, despite all precautions, you simply can't avoid them. About a week later, I was working in the Shoreham bee yard with Kirk. He was evaluating colonies, figuring out which ones were weak enough that they'd need a dollop of sugar syrup to get them through to the real spring. As we worked through the morning, the air around us was filling with bees, flushed from the hive by the gathering warmth. They seemed unbothered by us. "I think it's going to be a good day for gathering pollen," Kirk said. "They're getting calmer and calmer." Indeed, some early risers were already returning with the day's first cargo, their saddlebags filled not with the dull yellow silver maple pollen of the week before, but with egg yolk yellow grains. "That's red maple," Kirk said. "You can tell how far away the tree is by how much they carry," he added. "These are pretty light loads, which means they've had to come quite a ways. They can calculate exactly how much they should be carrying." Now, how they do that figuring is something of a mystery, as is their ability to navigate. These ladies had likely traveled a mile to the red maple trees and then navigated back to their particular hive, one of 80 strewn about this small bee yard. They'd coped with wind and with the sun winking in and out behind the clouds. Their GPS was wonderfully precise, or, and here comes the first part of the metaphor, comically precise. "Watch this," said Kirk, and he turned one box 90 degrees so that the small slit door on the bottom was about 8 inches away from where it had been before. Instantly, bees began stacking up like airplanes above O'Hare on a rainy day. They were lining up at exactly the spot where the slit should have been. And when it wasn't there, they had no way of finding it. All they could do was hover desperately. It was hard for both of us to watch, and after about 30 seconds, we relented and turned the box back around, and the machine resumed operations immediately. This doesn't mean bees are stupid, but as individuals, they are simple, capable of prodigious feats of navigation, strong enough to carry great loads all day, every day, but simple in their approach. They do one thing, they do it well. I thought of those bees that night in a lecture hall at Middlebury. A freshman had reserved it to show a new documentary about the Koch brothers, and she asked me to speak afterwards since I appeared briefly in the film. It was not a subtle movie. The Kochs, it insisted, with lurid graphics and sad vignettes, are destroying the planet, trying to resegregate schools, suppressing the voting rights of minorities, and warping democracy with massive donations. All, from my experience, exactly correct. In fact, that day, the Koch brothers' front group, Americans for Prosperity, had announced a $3.6 million swing state ad campaign targeting the Democrats for slowing down the Keystone Pipeline. It fired the usual volley of complete untruths. The pipeline would create zillions of jobs, things like that. In fact, as we now know from the company's own estimate, once it's built, it will take 35 people to run the pipeline from Canada to Texas. If you run an ad like this enough times, though, and $3.6 million buys a lot of times, people believe it. I'd been getting calls from panicked senatorial candidates saying they were losing big on the issue. I did what I could. I spent the afternoon writing op-eds, carefully laying out the facts, but as I was under no illusion that they would count as much as the endless ads. So I was a little frustrated even before I watched the movie, and realized that the Koch brothers were realizing that the Koch brothers were doing the same thing on a dozen other issues made me surlier still. When the movie was over and the house lights came up, another professor and I took the stage for a discussion. A student asked what we thought of the Citizens United decision when the Supreme Court said that corporations should have the same rights as people. My colleague answered first. He said, yes. He said, more speech was always better. Companies were in fact composed of people. It was a good idea. I could have answered empirically. By that point, it was clear that the 2012 election was already turning into a battle of billionaires. But I was thinking of the bees still, and so I said something a little more philosophical. The reason we shouldn't count corporations as humans isn't that they're bad, it's that they're simple, I began. They do the thing they do with great power. If you need a car built or an oil well drilled, a corporation is an amazing tool. It can gather resources from great distances, carry them exactly where they're needed, and combine various skills to produce something of great value from crude raw materials. They can, that is, gather grains of pollen and produce honey. But being powerful is not the same as being complex. Real human beings are complicated. Yes, we have instinctual desires and cravings that drive much of our behavior, just like corporations are like bees. But those instincts are tempered by strange and wonderful forces outside ourselves, such as art, the making of something of significance out of nothing, or religion, which at least as far back as the Buddha has taught us to suspect some of our instincts and cravings. We can remember our ancestors. We can imagine our grandchildren. And so sometimes we act in odd and counter-instinctual ways. We may cry when we see a hungry person, even empty our pockets to feed him. In extreme cases, we may give our lives over to that kind of service. Or we sometimes vote for politicians who will raise our taxes and give the money to the poor. Or we go to jail because we worry about global warming. The precise glory of humans is that we're complicated, and those complications are what rein us in, what might still, say, keep us from deciding to tap the tar sands of Canada or cut down the rainforests of the Amazon. A corporation, far more wonderful in its abilities to execute a plan than any of us individuals, is nonetheless uncomplicated. It doesn't care much about the past and can't think very far into the future. If it does, its shareholders will rebel. It's less like a person than like a bee, at least in this regard. So, given the power of speech like a real human, it will not use it to reflect or to check itself or to think about the larger good. It will simply put this new power to work on its single-minded goal of amassing wealth, just like the Koch brothers, sublimely unconcerned that their tar sands investments were threatening the planet, just like Chevron, happy to spend its money to make sure that it got its way in Washington. In other words, if your goal is to efficiently tap the tar sands, you need a corporation. But to decide if tapping the tar sands is a good idea, you need to keep corporations out of it. Their relentless simplicity will combine with their wealth to overwhelm reason and science and love. If you want honey, you need a hive of bees. But if you were trying to decide if making honey was a good idea, bees would be the last creatures to ask. You know what their answer is going to be. In fact, if you get in their way, they'll be perplexed for a little while trying to find the door. And if you persist in getting in their way, they're eventually going to get mad and sting. That's just how it works. Hence the need to stand up to that money and that misbegotten power of speech with actual speech and actual intention. Hence the need sometimes to do those counter-instinctual things. I do not think all of you need to go to jail, but I do think probably some of you do in the time ahead. I'll tell you a little story about that civil disobedience that we did, just to kind of two stories, because there were two things about it that seemed unusual and interesting to me. I mean, I wrote the letter asking people to come get arrested. And when I wrote it, one of the things I said was, I do not think college kids should have to be the cannon fodder here. Young people have been providing the leadership, most of it, in this fight. But if you're, 22 right now, it's possible that a arrest record might be a suboptimal item on your resume, going forward. One of the few unmixed blessings of growing older is, past a certain point, what the hell are they going to do to you, And so it was with pleasure that we watched people with, hairlines like mine arrive in D.C. We did not ask people when they got arrested, how old are you, because that would be rude, but we did, with some cleverness, I think, ask them, who was president when you were born? And the two biggest cohorts came from the FDR and the Truman administrations. Okay. And on the last day, there was a guy arrested with a sign around his neck that said, World War II vet, handle with care. All right. He was old enough that he'd been born in the Warren Harding administration, which was long enough ago that, frankly, I'd forgotten there was a Warren Harding administration, all right? In other words, young people, it was really good to see your elders starting to act like elders and to carry out the role they're supposed to carry out in a society, okay? Not trying to hang on to what they had, but trying to help shape the future for you. That's how civilization should work. The other thing that was unusual about those arrests, and you saw the pictures up there, was that we told people, if you come to get arrested, would you please wear a dress or a necktie, okay? Not because, you can tell I'm not a very, Vermont makes Northern California look very formal, But we wanted to make a point, a visual point, and it's the same point that undergirds what I've been trying to say tonight. And it's important. There's nothing radical about what I've been talking about at all. Nothing. All we're asking for is a world that works a little bit like the one we were born onto, a world that works like The Holocene, the period, the last 10,000 years, this period of benign climatic stability that underwrote the rise of human civilization, where every person who we have any record of lived, you know, under those conditions. Asking for something like that to persist is not a radical request. If you think about it, it's a very conservative demand. Radicals work at all companies. If you are willing to get up in the morning and make your fortune by altering the chemical composition of the atmosphere, then you're engaged in a very radical act. I mean, I wasn't really around for the 60s, but my sense is that the most wild-eyed 60s radical didn't occur to them that they were going to change the temperature of the earth, you know? This is radical in an entirely new way, and our job is to check that radicalism, not to invest in it, not to profit from it, not to slowly hope that it makes a... It is time to end it before it does any more damage. I cannot promise you we can win this fight. I don't know. We waited a very long time indeed to get started, something for which I'm ashamed. I should have figured it out earlier on that we needed these kind of movements. So I can't promise you we're going to win. Physics is ahead right now. It's not a good sign that the Arctic melted last year. But I can promise you something I didn't know 4 or 5 years ago, which is that there is for sure going to be a fight. And you've seen the pictures of some of the people who are with you in that fight. And we need some of you doing hard things, like someday going to jail, whatever, and we need all of you doing easy things, like making sure that, say, Dominican is not invested and implicated in this kind of work. We need everybody pitching in. And we need to do it without that guarantee of success, you know, and that makes it harder. Dr. King was always able to say to people, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. This may take a while, but we're going to win. They had to be very brave people in the civil rights movement, braver than we do. No one's going to shoot you. One hopes for talking about global warming. But they had the comfort of knowing they would win eventually. The arc of the physical universe appears to be short, and it appears to bend toward heat. If we don't act quickly, we will not win. You know, we will watch over geologic time as the earth that we were given to steward deteriorates and degrades. And so it is our honor and our privilege to get to be alive at the time when the most important question that's yet faced our species is being faced, and to get to do something about it without knowing how it comes out. And I will just look forward to being shoulder to shoulder with y'all in that fight. Thank y'all so much. We have time for a couple of questions.
One person asked a really good question, I thought. Every time I turn on MSNBC, I see BP and Chevron and Shell doing ads about all these wonderful things they are doing for the environment. What is that all about?
That's all about lying, really. It's been... I don't mean to be cynical. Sometimes I get a little cynical. I try not to be. But basically, if you look at the annual report or an ad from any of the oil companies, the more pictures of penguins they show, the more damage they're doing. BP is a good example. 15 years ago, BP announced that it was joining the revolution, and in fact, its initials would now stand for Beyond Petroleum. And they invested hundreds of millions of dollars in a new logo. They invested very little money in the sun and the wind, about 4% of their research budget, while they continued to look for massive amounts of petroleum. But even those investments ceased 2 years ago. They sold their wind and their solar divisions, as did Shell, as all these guys. There's just too much money to be made right now in fossil fuel. The return on investment for these companies is very high because they don't have to pay for the price of putting out their waste. And so for the moment, those are just lies. And that's why we need to divest from them. They have the capacity, perhaps, to become energy companies once we've overcome their ability to prevent the kind of rational legislation that economists have called for a long time. But right now, there are, as I say, a rogue force. They have just the numbers are staggering. Exxon alone has in its reserves something like 7% of the carbon necessary to take the planet past 2 degrees. One company, one board of directors can do 7% of the job of tanking the Earth. Those are just, that's just craziness.
I have several questions here about Monsanto and their grip on the whole food system on the planet.
Well, you guys had a golden opportunity to do something about Monsanto and GMOs in the last election, and you balked at the last minute, which was sad. I think in Vermont we're going to pass that law this year with any luck. We'll see. But a big ag is a big player in all of this, obviously, and I think that actually the most effective way that I can think of to make quick change in the way that we run our food system is also to put a serious price on carbon. There's nothing as dependent as cheap fossil fuel as our sort of over-corporatized agriculture. It's important that we get around to doing that. The phrase we learned best from the last decade should have been too big to fail. Mm-hmm. And it's not only our financial system that was brittle and vulnerable and top-heavy, it's our energy and our agricultural systems as well. And we need in all cases to localize, spread out, disperse, make things hardier, less vulnerable. And that's important work. And there's some real prophets in this room, people like Jerry Mander, who've written a lot about why that scale of things is, in the end, just untenable. Happily, we can do better. The best thing that's happened in this country in the last decade is the rise of kind of local agriculture again. I've given you a lot of depressing statistics. Here's a good one. 3 years ago, the USDA said, for the first time in 150 years, there are more farms in America instead of fewer. The biggest demographic trend in America since the end of the Civil War sort of bottomed out. And I mean, it's going to be a while. There's still more prisoners in America than there are farmers, but at least we're heading in the right direction.
I think we'll ask one more. A couple of people have asked in different ways. I don't have any money in the stock market because I don't have any money, said one man. I think it's a man, maybe it's a woman. And so what can I do?
So don't worry about your own personal divestment so much. I mean, if you go to the website we set up, gofossilfree.org, you can help find the kind of mutual funds and things that are fossil fuel free, and I think there'll be many, many more of them. And I'm sure that if you're, work with groups like Private Ocean or things, they can help you figure out how to do that kind of investing. And you should. But what we're looking for is political impact here. What we need is institutions that people respect severing their ties with this industry, saying that it is a rogue industry they do not want to be associated with. So we need people who are applying to colleges, writing to those colleges and saying, have you divested yet? And that's one of the ways I'm going to figure out where I want to go to school. We need people who are alumni of colleges saying, not I hate you and don't ever want to have anything to do with you again, saying just the opposite. I love my college. I love my time at Dominican. And I was taught physics there, and I was taught philosophy there, and I know that both those things mean that we can't go on as we've gone, and we can't pretend that money is morally neutral, and that we need to stand up as a community and cut our ties from this industry, just as people 25 years ago said we can't pretend that apartheid is a kind of morally neutral activity in which we're going to. None of us can avoid using a certain amount of fossil fuel in our daily lives. That's how the system is at the moment. You might want to take the train, but if there isn't a train to take, then you can't do it. But all of us can avoid profiting from it and from keeping the institutions, the churches and synagogues, the colleges, the cities that we love, from being part of that machine. And that would be a real, real service to this planet. It's a service, in the end, just to, if nothing else, telling the truth, saying it's the truth of our time, what's happening here, and we need to actually be honest about it and confront what it means, even when it's a little uncomfortable, just to the kind of standard ways of doing things. Education is supposed to be a tiny bit uncomfortable, you know? If you come to college and you spent 4 years there and you weren't uncomfortable at some point in it, then it wasn't a very good education that you got, you know? And you need to take that education and with it make things uncomfortable for people who deserve a little bit of discomfort at the moment. Thank you all so
much.
Thank
you. Thank you all so much for being here tonight, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks when Malcolm Gladwell comes.
Thank you for joining us for the live broadcast of Dominican University of California's Institute for Leadership Studies lecture series. This is Penguin Radio at radio.dominican.edu.